opened Fresh Air today with a 1934 Jimmy Lunsford recording of Stomp It Off. The second movie based on the popular TV series Star Trek recently opened in movie theaters around the country. The TV series Star Trek will be the subject of this week's edition of Charles Hardy's Popular Culture Show, which we feature every Thursday at 4 o'clock. Well, more specifically, the subject today will be a Marxist analysis of Star Trek as given by Douglas Kellner. Every Thursday at 3:30, Francis Davis hosts Interval, our weekly review of new jazz releases. Today, new albums by the Art Ensemble of Chicago and Air. Rosalie Sorrell's autobiographical song Traveling Lady is about how she left the role of housewife for the life of a traveling folk singer. After years on the road, Rosalie Sorrell's recently settled in the Delaware Water Gap. She'll be with us in about 40 minutes and will also sing a cappella. The Fairmount Park Art Association recently commissioned several artists to create outdoor public sculptures. One of those artists is my guest Raphael Ferrer, who chose to do his piece at 4th and Lehigh in Fairhill Square, which is a Vespocket park in a largely Hispanic neighborhood. There's benches, a small playground, and a small arc-shaped brick and concrete building which house the bathrooms. Raphael Ferrer designed his sculpture to crown this building. Now sitting on top of this curving building is a piece called El Gran Teatro de la Luna, which translates to the Big Theater of the Moon. This carnival-like piece has patterned jugglers, dancers, and acrobats. One balances on a pyramid of red and yellow balls, while another is wrapped around the circumference of a wheel, while a dancer balances on one foot while holding the other foot. And the colors and images create a vibrant scene of motion and balance. This is not the first neighborhood sculpture that Raphael Ferrer has created. His 1980 piece, Puerto Rican Sun, which is a brightly patterned sun suspended between two 25-feet-high steel-sheeted palm trees, is installed in the South Bronx. Raphael Ferrer was born and grew up in Puerto Rico. He moved to Philadelphia in 1966. He's a musician as well as a sculptor. He used to play timbales in the Tito Rodriguez band in Puerto Rico and played with several salsa bands in New York. He taught at the Philadelphia College of Art for 10 years, though he's never really formally studied art. He said one-man shows at the Albright Knox Gallery in Buffalo, Chicago's Museum of Contemporary Art, the Whitney Museum, and the Leo Castelli Gallery. Raphael Ferrer, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Let's talk first about the commission work that just got installed that you did at 4th and Lehigh. What did you choose that park for your sculpture?
Well, the association was very generous with all the artists, and essentially they gave a map of the city. And the concept behind the whole project is that they want to seed the city parks with different works by different artists. I looked at a number of places, but then Penny Bach, who's a wonderful, terrific person who is responsible for the success of this whole venture, especially my particular work, which has just been completed, she gave me a list of places and added to it details that were interesting. Insofar as the Fairhill Square Park, it is in an area where there is a strong community where you find a tremendous involvement in terms of the businessmen of the area, which tend to be Latin or Hispanic. They've done a kind of renaissance in this block of gold, or bloque de oro, as they call it. The sidewalks are paved in this very peculiar way for a northern city, which is there are two colors. They're black and yellow, and they have this kind of undulating, almost samba-like beat through the sidewalks of Fifth Street. So I saw the whole place. I saw lots of wall murals. I saw the hospital, which kind of gives a very stable aspect to that particular part of the park. So these things really were very interesting to me, and I figured that if I was going to wind up, like all the other artists, picking a park, this definitely was a park that was more simpatico for me.
Do you have any personal connection to the park?
None whatsoever. Actually, I had never gone to the park before I went there with Penny the first time.
I guess it's kind of funny in a way that the building that your sculpture sits on top of is really the building that houses the public toilets.
Yeah, and there's even a more fascinating part to that story, which is as all these commissions go, you're initially approached by a group of people, then you present a verbal kind of idea of what you want to do. Then the idea takes a slow form insofar as that they have to make up their minds as what they want to do or not do. Finally, going through these phases, I wound up from an extreme of wanting to do a subway station where I wanted to put all these boats and wall things, etc. I wanted to do perhaps even the subway station nearest to 30th Street Station, because I used to go there commuting to New York a lot. From that kind of extreme nightmare, which it really would have been a nightmare to do that, to a more realistic thing, which was, I said to these people that I would really like to conceive the idea of making a kind of theater that could function visually when nothing was happening, and that would be available for the people to use for concerts, for just informal jam sessions in the summer, and so on and so forth. That was my original proposal, and they were very excited by it. Then I went away in the summer, and I came back early fall and went back to visit my park to get a little more specific with my design. And lo and behold, there was this bizarre, strange, ominous kind of building, almost a something from World War II, like from the Maginot Line or from the German bunkers facing the Calais coast of England. So I said, wow, this is a very strange building, and there's something really magnetic about it. So I kept looking at my original site, which was in the center of the park, but I kept being attracted by this instant piece of cement cake that was there. And it slowly came to me that that's what I had to do. I had to deal with this thing. And it was a given that was fabulous, because the amount of money that they spent to build the building would have been totally out of the question insofar as incorporating that into a commission for my work. So having the building there, and the building having like a 3 or 4 staircase type thing in the front, which becomes a stage-like thing, it already incorporated at least 50% of what my ideas were. So then the crowning of the building was the final thing, and it was wonderful. And I think the nicest compliment is that so many people say to me, if I design the building, which of course, I mean, I cannot conceive that I would ever be able to design such a building or any building for that matter, but it was really nice that it worked to that extent.
One of the things that I really like about it is that all the figures are on top. They're all in motion or they're balancing. And it's the kind of, one of the things people use parks for is to bring out their radios and listen to music and talk and hang around, and the piece seems to work perfectly with the kind of activity that you go to a park to have.
Yes, yes, that's absolutely true. And that was the part that I had already thought about with my original theater, which would have these figures, but in a more technically complicated way, because I would have to have figured a way that they could disappear and reappear when they were going to be used or not used. And in this case, that's not an issue at all. And moreover, it really does complete the building. And now, being a bit more serious about the architecture of the building itself, the Parks Commission were very wonderful, and they accepted the idea, and they were not at all put off by the fact that it was not a negative statement on the building at all. It was a very positive statement about kind of joining the building to make this kind of terrific thing possible.
I don't want to make light of the function of the building either. It houses the two bathrooms, which
yes,
is
yes.
An important function. It's great when parks have them, but they're locked.
They're locked, but you know, I have the latest flash from Fairhill Square is that when we opened the thing in the formal inauguration that took place last Friday, the key was delivered to the watchman who is in charge of the park. So now the bathrooms are now open. So those people who are in the area now that would like to try to see if we're telling the truth can rush in there now and try to use the bathrooms.
When I went to see the piece the other day, I said, oh, wow, he painted the bathroom doors too. And I said, no, that's graffiti. I said, no, that's part of the piece. And I said, no, it must be graffiti. And I went back and forth and back and forth. Would you describe the bathroom doors and what you did?
Well, I love what you said. I love the fact that you were ambivalent and you could not tell whether it was graffiti or not. I did that, and it was an on-the-job spot, an on-the-spot job that I did the day of the installation. And I had thought about it because the doors, being a very kind of nice blue, were already being graffitied. And knowing a bit of the psychology of graffiti, which essentially is about decoration and about a manifestation of the individuality of people who have a need to do that. These are like poets. I'm sure some people listening would be horrified to hear me say that, but I would say that not all poetry is good and not all graffiti is good. So there, that takes care of the criticism about graffiti being good or bad. But the point is that there is that element of expression which is important. And these people are not really concerned with trying to obliterate each other's work. And my experience with the South Bronx when I did The Puerto Rican Sun was because my work is expressionistic by nature and very colorful and full of movement through the multiple layers of color in the work itself, it doesn't really welcome graffiti. Rather, it absorbs it and swallows it in a cannibal-like form. And there are bits of graffiti in the Puerto Rican Sun, which is now almost 3 years old, or perhaps a little more, and you can hardly see them unless you get very close. You see these very timid kinds of little signatures. But again, there's another aspect which I think is very interesting. I was showing slides of palm trees, real palm trees, and if you see these beautiful, gnarled old palm trees in the tropics, they're all carved with graffiti. But it was another era. It's the time of our fathers and mothers, etc. And I guess love affairs and personalities lasted longer than they do today, so they had to use a knife to cut into the tree, whereas today they just use a spray can, which does not last that long. So the history of this notion of putting your name on something is really quite old, and it's not a phenomenon that really has to do with anything from the 60s on, as some people tend to think.
Would you be offended if there was graffiti either on your piece at 4th and Lehigh or your piece in the South Bronx?
I refuse to answer the question on the grounds that it would incriminate me, meaning that I don't want to encourage people to do it. Obviously, if they do it, it doesn't bother me. I don't lose sleep over it. The only graffiti artists that I am dreadfully afraid of are minimal artists, and they have not yet hit the streets. This would be the graffiti artists that would come out of the schools from the 60s who are so indoctrinated in the ideology of minimal art, which tends to have everything either all white or all black. And I think it would be a horror to me to see my sculpture suddenly from these colorful figures to see these ghosts either all white or all black, which would then only have make me go back and start all over again. But there are no minimal graffiti artists, so I really don't have anything big to worry about right now.
What reaction have you gotten from the people in the neighborhood in Fair Hill Square?
It's been a wonderful reaction. The people have been incredibly friendly. They've come around. And I'm talking now about a totally bilingual community. I'm talking about blacks, whites, old white families that have lived there for many, many years who came around, and they were there during the installation and they spoke to us and they were so terrific. I mean, they said, gee, this is great. It's like the city's giving us something. It's something that completes the park. The people in the hospital were very happy about it. And the children, of course, love it because it just has that kind of festive quality to it. So in a way, I mean, I hate to sound gushy and stuff about it, but it seems to be working and it seems to be successful insofar as that's concerned.
Rafael Ferreira is my guest, if you're just joining us. And the piece that we're talking about was recently installed at 4th and Lehigh in Fair Hill Square. Now, another outdoor piece, Puerto Rican Sun, is in the South Bronx, which even people who haven't been there know through the media is a very bombed-out-looking territory now. How did your piece... How did you end up making a piece for that area?
I was approached by a woman who was head of this Bronx Redevelopment Association, which was one of the many small groups that are trying to redevelop very small segments of the Bronx. And the thing about the Bronx, it has this reputation of, as you said, of being a bombed-out borough. And it is true to a great extent. But then within that bombed-out kind of World War II scenario, you find pockets of renaissance, which are wonderful, where you find grocery stores, playgrounds, hospitals, schools, etc., and they're all functioning, and it's very placid because the kind of crime and kind of urban terror that went on in the 70s is gone because that's when those buildings were totally demolished and burned and stuff like that. So when these people approached me, they literally offered me a number of sites, and most of them were attractive to artists of another persuasion that would want to create something more in a conceptual vein, like making a hole in the ground and filling it with broken glass. That was one of the proposals. And someone mentioned that there was plenty of glass all over the Bronx already. But in any case, in my decision to pick this site, I found, again, a pocket of life, that there was a corner's lot close to a basketball court. The lot was being used for 3 or 4 years up to that time by the neighborhood to grow vegetables in the summer. Now, that seemed to me a terrific thing, and I saw the beds of where they would plant the vegetables. So I said to them that I wanted to make something that would really contribute to that site and kind of give it a solidity that would make the city pay attention to it in some way and therefore bring more to it. And that was the rationale behind it, and that's how the Puerto Rican Sun came out, which really is two palm trees that create this kind of entrance or archway, and the sun is entwined in the fronds of the palm trees at the top, so it really makes a portal or an entrance into this vegetable garden for the people.
I get the feeling there's a lot of public art that you're not very excited by.
No, I'm not very excited about a lot of public art, and I don't think the people are very excited either, which is a tricky topic to get into, because one does not want to say that one is doing art for the people. I certainly would never say that. I mean, I really would never say that. So I don't want to come on your program and sound like I'm some kind of a beneficial kind of do-gooder, because I'm just as egotistical as any other artist is. But I think that I have to take into consideration the realities of places, and I think that's very important. And I think, in a great sense, minimal art, because it reflected a kind of arrogance that was present in the culture during the 60s and early 70s. It was a manifestation of the ignoring of the realities of the cult of the expressions of the culture at the most elementary form by those people that had a lot of power. In a great sense, it reflects a very clear attitude that was present in Vietnam. Not many people have talked about that.
And what's the connection?
Well, I think the connection is an arrogance of power. It's an arrogance of imposing something that essentially is totally mute, as mute as napalm, or as mute as a white box in the middle of a square. And it's a kind of muteness that wants to address an issue that speaks with a neon sign that says intelligence. But it's an intelligence that has to be approached through such a specialized way that is really beyond the reach of most people. In other words, I do see that these works work extremely well, and they're very powerful in a museum context. But when you bring them out into the streets, where you have to deal with the reality of life, with all the sweaty kind of abrasiveness that life has, it becomes a bit galling, and I think for a good reason.
Does the success that you've had in museums carry over when you're doing a piece for a neighborhood? Does success in the art world mean anything when your art is on the street?
It does not really mean anything, because when you approach these things, you approach them with the same kind of it begins in a kind of blindness, where you do your work in your studio and you're doing it with yourself and with your own imagination and with your energies. Then there comes a moment when you realize that it's going to be going outside, and it's going to be seen by a lot of people that would never even see it in a museum. So that reality exists, but it never really enters your consciousness until it's too late. And then when it's up there, by my nature, and I don't know how other artists respond, but I just feel like another bystander, and I'm very fascinated. But it doesn't connect emotionally to me anymore. It's something that is out of my hands. And I love it to be that way, because I would hate to go around with all these children that I would have to worry about and care about.
You're a musician as well as an artist, and you've played with several bands, both in Puerto Rico and in New York. What are the differences between the pleasures you've had as a musician and the pleasures you've had as an artist? And the different ways that you connect with your audiences in both roles.
The pleasures of being a musician are fantastic, and they really are so sensual and so physical that it's almost difficult to... I guess it's just as difficult as trying to explain a visual thing from fine art in words. It's very difficult to put it in language. But the thing is, speaking about the reality of both worlds, the music world and the art world, the music world and being a drummer, it's not being a musician, I was a drummer. So being a drummer has a very limited situation, which is that the drummer really is the low man on the totem pole of the band, meaning that although he carries the beat, he imposes the drive, he does connect with the audience in a very direct way. He does not have a very eloquent voice, because the most eloquent voices are manifested by the pianist and above all by the dictator, which is always the band leader, who are these people who are totally fascistic in their control. And I think they have to be that way. I learned that after I quit, that they really had to be these very, very stern disciplinarians in order to impose their own concept into the work that they were doing. But when I was a musician, I was a very neurotic person, because I was totally frustrated, because I would think if I played maybe 5 or 6 times in 10 years that I was really accelerated at the height of what I thought music could offer me, that would be a lot if I did it 5 or 6 times. The rest of the time was promises that were never fulfilled. It was just this really incredibly dreary, sordid kind of life where you just kept playing Begin to Begin 15 times a night for people in some place out in Elizabeth, New Jersey, in a bar with people sitting around and saying to you, "Well, don't you ever laugh?" Things like that. So slowly, because I had been fortunate, I had been exposed to art on my own while I was studying at Syracuse University. I had that always in the stove, so to speak, cooking, and it became more and more and more important to me. And as I was a musician and living in New York City, I was always going to the Museum of Modern Art, going to the galleries, educating myself, reading, learning, looking, and painting more and more and more. And as I did this more, I realized that it gave me something that music would never give me. As a painter or as a sculptor, I could be my own nightclub owner, band leader, composer, and soloist. And that's the freedom that art gives you, which music does not give you. Music gives you instant excitement, but it also gives you an incredible pressure that... As you get older and more, I think, more rational, you realize that the art is so wonderful, because you can do it for yourself and with yourself.
Well, before we talk some more about music and art, why don't we listen to a selection from an album whose leader you used to play with. And we're going to be hearing the Tito Rodriguez Band, and you used to play with them in Puerto Rico. Do you want to say a little bit about the band and about the selection we're going to be hearing?
Well, Tito Rodriguez was probably one of the most important band leaders in New York City of the generation when I began to be excited with the desire to be a drummer. Tito Puente was the other one, and they were both rivals. Tito was a singer. Unfortunately, he died quite young, and he was a terrific person. I liked him much more. Once I didn't play with him, and I really didn't play with him for a long time. I only played with him maybe on 3 occasions, and we were friends, and he was a fascinating person with this really almost Napoleonic complex about things. And the thing that I can tell you that was the most fascinating aspect of his personality, that in a way I really sympathize with, and this might sound peculiar to some of the audience, but in any case, he approached music and being a band leader the way a general would approach an activity. He always considered it a war that had to be won at all costs. and that there would be no mercy given to the enemy. And this was absolutely true. I see you're smiling, but let me tell you, I mean, to see Tito go into a nightclub knowing that Machito and Tito Puente were going to be the other two bands on the stand that night, and see his absolute maniacal drive to be the hottest, most terrific swinging group playing was something really fabulous, and it really carried over to everybody else in the band, and it gave you this understanding that there is something exhilarating about combat when you're not dealing with killing people or things like that. You're dealing with the level of expressiveness rather than violence.
What would he do to fire you up?
Well, he'd just get into this horrible mood and start screaming at people and checking microphones and accusing people of sabotaging if the microphones were not working and saying that Tito Puente was the one that was doing it and so on and so forth.
Great. Well, let's hear a selection from the Tito Rodriguez Band. Do you want to introduce this for us?
The number is called Mango del Monte, and it's kind of a classic Latin number recorded by a lot of different groups. I would think that the origin of it probably is Cuban. And I think it's a very lively composition.
Let's hear it.
Voy pa'l monte, yo voy pa'l campo. De la fruta la que más me gustó fue el rico mango. Voy pa'l monte, yo voy pa'l campo. De la fruta la que más me gustó fue el rico mango. La 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 la. A mí me gustó aquel mango. La 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 la. A mí me gustó aquel mango. Voy pa'l monte, yo voy pa'l campo. De la fruta la que más me gustó fue el rico mango.
Tito Rodriguez in the band, and my guest is Rafael Ferrer, who played several times with Tito Rodriguez in Puerto Rico, and he's played with several salsa bands in New York as well. He's best known as a painter and sculptor, and his recently commissioned work, commissioned by the Fairmount Park Art Association, can be seen on 4th and Lehigh Streets. It's in a small park there called Fairfield Square. He's also got a commissioned work in the South Bronx in New York, and he's had one-man shows at many museums, including the Whitney in New York, and he's shown at the Leo Castelli Gallery, and has been represented in group shows at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Do you think music informs your art?
Yeah, I think it does, because I play this same music every day when I'm working, and even when I'm not working. For instance, I go to my gallery, is the Nancy Hoffman Gallery in New York City. It shows my work. And when I go to New York quite often, maybe sometimes twice a week, maybe once a week, maybe once every 2 weeks. But to me, New York is a one cassette drive. It takes 90 minutes to get there. So I have the cassette player playing salsa. And by the time I get to New York, I get radio hit. So I'm listening to this stuff all the time, and it really informs the works insofar as the drive and the energy and the improvisatory aspects of that music are very much a part of my thinking.
I think of your art as being very rhythmic also, particularly the piece on top of the building in Fairhill Square. There's just so much motion in it. And then the colors are really rhythmic also, I think.
Yeah, and I think that has to do with you know, the nature of where one comes from. I mean, I think those things, slowly you begin to realize who you are, where you come from, and what it means. And I'm not trying to make it sound quaint by saying that everybody from Latin countries has all these things, because it's not true. It's just like saying that cliche, all black people have rhythm. I mean, it's just very funny, because all those things are totally inaccurate. But the point is that there are these sources of energy that affect different people in different ways. And if you're fortunate enough to be in tune with that and to be able to make it a part of your life, then it can work for you.
Well, what kinds of sights and symbols and sounds did you grow up with in Puerto Rico?
Well, when I was very little, I always, even now, I remember music that was at an age where I could not even conceive that I would ever want to be a musician. And I do remember music from my childhood, meaning being 6, 7 years old. The ocean is the most important factor in my childhood, because that's where I went all the time to swim and to enjoy myself and then to grow up in. And then the sensuality of the ocean, of the not only the kind of poetic notion of nature being so lush in the tropics, but also people are so lush and so sensual. And you go to the ocean and you see these beautiful girls when you're growing up, and that's something that you want to go back and look more. And I mean, these are all parts of growing up in the tropics, and I'm sure that a lot of people that would be from the islands would find this very common.
You've made a lot of choices in terms of where to live. You've chosen the mainland at least part of the time. I think you also live part of the time in Puerto Rico.
I don't really live there. I go there quite often, but I live really in Philadelphia.
Why have you chosen the mainland over the island, and also Philadelphia over New York, because that's where the gallery that represents you is?
Well, the last question first. I didn't want to live in New York again. I lived there for 10 years as a musician. I know the city totally well, and I don't feel any need to subject myself to the kinds of anxiety that living in New York entails. It's become so crazy, not only in terms of real estate, but also everything else. So many of my friends that live in New York spend more time keeping New York out than enjoying it, whereas I think when I go to New York for a whole day, I can see so many more things and then enjoy the trip back and come back home here in Philadelphia. Philadelphia is a city that I love intensely. I've never wanted to live in any other place since I moved here in 66. It's a very civilized city. It has a wonderful kind of scale to it, which people from New York always respond to. They say, gee, this is a really nice city, and it's got all this press that people make fun of and stuff like that. But the thing is that it does have a very civilized kind of layout and setup, and it's very nice for me to work, and I like the quiet and anonymity. I'm not a party going person or a social person. So Philadelphia gives me the possibility to live in that way.
What about the mainland over the islands?
Well, Puerto Rico would be impossible to live. It's too painful to go back to a place where you were born in and grew up in, and that you have all these memories of. And the reality of Puerto Rico is so complicated that if we were to talk about it, it would probably be your most depressing program, and it would take a long time to get into it. But briefly, it simply seems to be the case that to many of my compatriots from Latin America that are in art or in literature, you get to a point where being too close to the sources of your fantasy is a very painful thing, and you can only take it in small doses, and you have to get away from it to get a perspective on it and to even be able to use it. It's almost like the cliche of living inside a perfume factory. I mean, that would be almost a nightmare if you lived in a perfume factory. You would have to be, you would lose your sense of smell. To enjoy perfume, you have to get it the way they give it, which is in very small doses. And I think there is a parallel to that, and my idea of why Puerto Rico is a very difficult place for me to live in.
Do you have to? Is part of Puerto Rico what you've imagined it to be, as well as what it is, as far as its inspiration to you? Is that like part of the reason for keeping distance?
What I imagine it to be is one thing, and what it is a totally different thing. And that's where the contradiction and the problem comes.
Do you have any shows or other pieces coming up in the near future that we can look forward to?
There is an exhibition of about 10 years of my work, a kind of a survey show, which will begin at the Laguna Gloria Museum in Austin, Texas in September. And that, I believe, will travel to a number of cities from St. Louis to, I believe, California and perhaps Chicago. And I don't know what the rest of the schedule is at this point because it's still being worked on. But that's going to be an interesting show to see because we'll have a kind of 10 years survey of the work that I've been doing up to the present.
We're really out of time. There's one more thing I'd be really curious about. You're pretty much self-taught. You know, you've attended universities and have a degree or degrees, but they're not in art.
I don't have any degrees.
Oh, you don't have any degrees. But you've taught at the Philadelphia College of Art. I'd really be interested in your impressions of art school and of how you taught as someone who was really outside of that academic art training.
Well, I taught as an innocent. I had a fantasy of what teaching was because I never learned art through a teacher. So I gave my students that fantasy, and it worked for quite a while. Things got difficult as I became better known. I don't think that bureaucracies like individuality. I think bureaucracies tend to want a kind of similarity. And that's a difficult contradiction within the sphere of art, because art, you have to underline the individual to deal with art. So obviously, the more these difficulties accelerated, the more my staying in these institutions was painful. So it came to a moment where I felt really that it was not going to be useful to continue that. So I have not taught. I love to give lectures and to talk to students. I don't believe in crits. I don't like to go to places and talk to people and tell them what I think about their work, because that's none of my business. I'm not an art critic. I love to talk to them about issues that we can share, about interests that we have in common, music, for instance. But I don't want to go and say, if you fix this corner, the painting will look better, because then that's my work and not their work. And I think that's an intrusion. But that's the way schools operate. They will operate in a kind of formula basis, and that's fine. And I really am not trying to make anything about education. It's got its own problems already.
Well, I've really enjoyed meeting you and talking with you, and I've really enjoyed your work also. Thanks so much for visiting with us on Fresh Air, and I hope
Thank you
can come
much,
back sometime.
Thank you very much, Terry. I would love to come back, and Great. It's been wonderful meeting you.
Good. Rafael Ferrer has been my guest. He's a Philadelphia-based artist, and his recently commissioned piece, which was just installed, is called El Teatro de la Luna, and it's in a small park, Fairhill Square, on 4th and Lehigh. And it kind of crowns the roof of a small building in that park. And he also did a piece called Puerto Rican Sun, which is in the South Bronx in New York City. And he said one-man shows at many museums, and his work is represented by the Nancy Hoffman Gallery in Manhattan. Well, it's 17 minutes to 3 o'clock, and this is Fresh Air on 91 FM. In just a few minutes, Singer Rosalie Sorrells will be my guest, and she'll be singing some a cappella songs for us. But before she joins us, let's listen to a selection from one of her recently recorded albums. This is a song that she wrote that's a very autobiographical song, so I think if you listen, it will help introduce you to her if you're not already familiar with her work and her life. This is called Traveling Lady.
In a big fine house with many rooms and a wide open door. All of my friends came to visit me there, but I don't answer that bell anymore. I used to live in a big fine house. I had rooms for 20 friends or more. Now I run begging from lover to friend for a pallet on any old floor. For I have gotten to be quite a rambler, going by the land and the sea. It was aprons and dustpans and such. Ah, but now I'm a traveling lady. Once it was me gave all the parties. Receive all my friends in a bar, and none of the glasses are mine. Ah, but the bars hold notions of freedom. I'm being one with the wind and the rain. Fogs over the windows of home. Oh, I have gotten to be quite a rambler. It was aprons and dustpans and such. Now, but now I'm a traveling lady. that's mine, but my shadow. If you need one, well, I'll give that away. Oh, I have gotten to be quite a landlord. I'm going by the land and by the sea. And once it was April, and dustpans and such. Ah, but now I'm a traveling lady. Now I'm a traveling lady. Don't you try to hang on.
And a two-bit brain, and they may not put me in the Hall of Fame, but I got a reputation and a well-known name, and I like it. And the folks back home might call me a flirt. It's been a mighty long time since I turned any dirt. I got pink and orange flowers on my turquoise shirt, and I like it. Yeah, I like it. Like it fine. Keep on rolling that show on down the line. I finish up here and make that as my nine. Making country music don't leave you any time, but I like it. Oh, yeah. Hat. I got a sneaky old agent who is getting too fat. I spent my last time for coffee in the laundromat, but I like it. I've got a fancy guitar and $1,000 amp and pretty gold sequins all over my pants, and I'm broke and they won't pay me in advance, and I like it. Yeah, I like it. I get fine. Hey, just keep on rolling that show on down the line. I finish up here and make that a spine line. Making country music don't leave you any time, but I like it. Oh, yeah. Even though the movies are beating down my door, if I want any cash, I better sing some more. I like that. Hey, now, boys and girls, don't get me wrong. It ain't that easy to sing a good song. And if you don't really mean it, you don't belong. And I like it. Yeah, I like it. Like it fine. Keep on rolling that show on down the line. I'll finish up here and make that a fine line. Making country music don't leave you any time. But I like it. Like it fine. Like it fine.
That was Rosalie Sorrell's two selections, I Like It and Traveling Lady. She wrote the song Traveling Lady, and they're both from an album called Traveling Lady Rides Again on Philo Records. And I should mention, one of the musicians on that album is Philadelphia-based Winnie Winston. Well, singer-songwriter and guitarist Rosalie Sorrell is in the studio with me, and I should say that she didn't start her adult life as a performer. She was a housewife and mother of several children, living in Utah when she started to sing and get involved with folk music. She later divorced and afterwards virtually lived on the road for many years. Last fall, she decided to settle down and chose Delaware Water Gap, Pennsylvania, as the place to do it. This quiet and pretty Pocono community is still reeling from a series of axe murders. One of the victims was a good friend of hers, and the police have been unable to track down the murderer. No one has been convicted. So she and several other Delaware Water Gap musicians are organizing a benefit concert, and I believe the proceeds are to go to hiring a private investigator. We'll be hearing more about this a little bit later. But the benefit concert for Ed Joubert will...
Joubert,
I'm sorry, will be on June 27th. That's a Sunday, and it will be all day from 1 in the afternoon till 9 at night. And it will be at the... right off Route 611, and we'll have directions for you in a little while. Among the performers will be Rosalie Sorrells, pianist John Coates, pianist and singer Bob Durow. For any more information about this concert, you can call area code 717-476-0407. Rosalie Sorrells, welcome to Fresh Air, and I'm glad you could be with us. And we're going to talk a little bit about this benefit concert a little later. I'd like to hear a little bit about your life. Can you tell us what was the source of that transition that you went through from housewife to performer living on the road?
Well, I always liked to sing, and when I was married, it was my hobby to collect old songs from both Utah and Idaho. The first album I ever made was right after the birth of my second child, and it was for Folkways, and it was called Folk Songs of Utah and Idaho. And I sang, I performed. I had a radio show. I taught for 10 years at the University of Utah while I was married. And I put on concerts there. I just didn't live on the road. But when my marriage broke up, which was, I suppose, related to the fact that I sang and was successful, but I don't think that had everything to do with it. That just contributed to it. The fact is that I didn't know how to do anything. I married when I was 19 years old, and I knew how to take care of children and clean the house and cook and sing. And the options that that gives you in terms of finding a way to support yourself are pretty limited. So I decided to sing. Because I had so much, I had 4 albums by the time my marriage broke up. And I had very specific material that nobody else had. I did a lot of stuff for the American Folklore Society, and it used to be in the colleges before the folk music commercial success during the 60s, and even for a while after, before that coffee house circuit came about, where the kids really have control of the money. It was possible to go and do concerts of real folk music and be paid for it as though you were someone with information to impart to people who wanted to learn something. That is not true much anymore. It's very hard to do concerts in universities on any kind of a circuit unless you're just entertaining people in a beer parlor, and I don't care to sing the folk songs of the Mormon pioneers in that context. But when I began, I made a pretty good sum of money each month doing 2 or 3 concerts, much more than I could have made working, say, at a truck stop or doing anything else I could have done.
Now, I don't think you were Mormon, but you lived in Utah where there is a large Mormon community. Was it accepted in your neighborhood when you started to perform?
Well, when I was a married woman with children and I was doing it for a hobby, it was certainly accepted. It wasn't accepted at all after. But I didn't stay in Utah. I went back up to Idaho.
That's where you were born.
Yeah. I had... my politics were not acceptable up there any more than the fact that I went out on the road and left my children with a babysitter. When I heard that question before, I was thinking that Bolinas, California, is the only place I ever lived where everybody approved of me. I loved it there. I don't know why I ever left. But everybody who lived out there was a poet or an artist or a craftsman or something like that, and so nobody thought it was a strange way to make a living. They sure did in Boise, Idaho.
Because a lot of people seem to run into problems in their hometowns when they change their lifestyle at all or become something different from what people expected them to be or what it's acceptable to become.
Yeah, I guess that's probably true. I know it took years for me to get anyone to hire me to sing in my hometown. I probably can walk down almost any street in New York City and run into more people who I'd like to run into. That's funny. I felt very bitter toward my hometown for a long time. I guess I'm getting over it now.
In one of your albums, there's several Mormon folk songs about the Mormon settlers and the life of Mormon men and women. I'm going to ask you to sing one in a couple of minutes, but can you tell us like how you learned about this? Was it through living in Utah, or was it through more, intellectual, folkloric circles that you got the songs?
Well, I collected those songs from people who sang them. But for intellectual reasons, I guess. I was an amateur collector, and I think I did some pretty good work. But I was brought up in a very literate family. Even though I didn't go to college, I still had an extremely good education at home, and I was always interested in the history of my own community, wherever I lived. And I was just fascinated by the Mormon people. They really made up songs about everything they did. And their history is... you could spend forever going into what happened with the Mormon people. It's just fascinating. They're very particular individuals, and it's really interesting to track down some of those songs. I got a lot of them by going to the Daughters of the Utah Pioneers quilting sessions, and I'd sing a couple of old songs and then say I was looking for more, and they'd come and give them to me.
Can you sing one of them for us?
Sure. I think my favorite one is the title cut on that album you're talking about, The Lonesome Roving Wolves. There must be 40 or 50 songs that I've, not that I know all of them, but that I've seen about crossing the plains. And most of them are real jolly and sound like a bunch of people on their way to a picnic. But this one's more like what it was really like. And it's not common to find it. I've only heard it from two people. And once it was a full version and the other one was kind of fragmentary. But I learned it from a woman whose father crossed the plains in a covered wagon. And... it was his description of what the crossing was like.
The Mormons were camped down by the green grove where the clear waters flow from the mountains above. The wind it approached all chilly and cold, and we listened to the howling of those lonesome roving wolves. The groans of the dying were in our camp, and the cold, chilly frost, it was seen on our tent, and the fear in our hearts can never be told. And we listened to the howling of those lonesome roving wolves. The grave of the stranger we left on the plain, down by the green grove, there forever to remain, to remember his grave. We left ashes and coals. to hide him from the savages and the lonesome roving wolves. But early next morning, just at the break of day, the drums and the fifes did play a reveille. Our mules were brought in, our baggage far to pull. And now we'll bid adieu to those lonesome roving wolves.
That's very beautiful. Rosalie Sorrells is my guest, and the song that she just sang is a Mormon folk song. What spirit were those songs sung in when you lived in Utah?
Well, now I collected these songs from people who, you know, it was just 100 years from when they came there, who sang them. But the people in the church didn't sing them that much. I had to really dig for them. They weren't commonly sung.
In your album, there's a few songs about being a Mormon woman and being a wife, and some were sung by Mormons and some were sung by people who weren't Mormons and who would warn women from marrying a
Well, actually, that song you're thinking of, Don't Marry the Mormon Boys, right? That's a real common song in all areas. In Corvallis, it's Don't Marry the Corvallis Boys. There's a Don't Marry the Texas Boys. It's more women in general warning you to shy away from marriage. It's not particularly meant. I learned that from a Mormon woman. And when I used to go to those quilting bees, they were great. I'd go, and they're mostly old women. And the old people had a great sense of humor about their past, and they would talk about polygamy. And the young people, it's a successful church, and they have that same sense of wanting a little respectability, and they don't want to talk about any of that stuff. But the old ladies were great. So, you know the song about Brigham Young, which I always thought of as a scurrilous song about Brigham Young. One day when I was singing it, that's on the first Utah and Idaho album, Folkways, 27 years ago. This lady came up and said, "Sing that song about Brigham Young." And I said, "Oh, I don't know that song." And she said, "Oh, I know you know that song. It's on your record." And I said, "Well, I didn't want to sing it because I might offend someone." And she said, "Oh, we all know that song." And when I went to singing it, they all joined in the chorus. They all knew it. They were great. They had a great sense of humor.
Were there songs that you grew up with that were passed on in your family?
Oh, yeah. My family liked all kinds of music. I didn't learn a lot of folk music in my family, although my mother's father sang things I regard as folk songs while he separated the milk and while he plowed. A lot of them, my grandmother would pop out and say, "Don't sing that in front of that child." But
the body songs?
Yeah, he sang a lot. He sang all the time. And my father's mother sang genuinely old ballads and songs. But my father sang in a lovely tenor voice a lot of the songs from the light operas, and he some of John McCormick's songs. Everybody sang just all different music.
Are any songs from your childhood in your current repertoire?
Sure. My grandfather used to sing this when he was separating the milk. He sang everything at separator tempo, kind of, you know. He learned it. He came from the South, and he learned it from a black man. "If you want to go to heaven, I'll tell you what to do. Just grease your foot with a mutton soup. Devil get after you with a red-hot hand. Slide right over to the promised land and run, Mary, run. Suffer and die, run, Mary, run. going to Galilee. Some come a-limping and some come lame. Some come a-running in religion's name. Mind now, sister, how you walk across. Your foot might slip and your soul get lost. Now, run, Mary, run. Suffer and die. Run, Mary, run. Gone to Galilee.
Was that one of the songs they didn't want you to hear?
No, that's just one I remember. It's a fragment. I think he's... No, probably the ones they didn't want me to hear, I shouldn't have been hearing.
and those are probably ones we shouldn't let you sing on the radio.
That's
also
probably,
right?
True.
When you're learning songs on the road, do you usually try to learn them from people at the source, you know, from people who are part of